from a female perspective. Now, when I do this, I don't mess with, okay, I'm a girl doing this monologue. But if I ever did get to perform this, she has the line, accoutred as I was, I plunged in and bade him follow. I can picture myself in a cocktail dress and heels going, dressed as I was, I plunged in and we were neck and neck, and then he starts to drown and I save him.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But no, he's the emperor and I'm just a little, you know, cater waiter. I think that would be so cool.
A circumstance all too familiar to very many of our listening audience here in New York City.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Welcome to the State of Shakespeare. My name is Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And in the studio today we have Celeste Chula.
Hello, boys.
If you recognize the voice that you're about to hear, it's because Celeste has done dozens of audiobooks. She is an extremely accomplished regional theater actor. She's appeared off-Broadway in She Stoops to Conquer, Exit the King, Merchant of Venice, Romeo and Juliet, and a laundry list of plays at the Pearl Theater Company. Regionally, she's done multiple seasons at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, including the world premiere of Duncan Cheek's Whisper House. She's done multiple shows at the Florida Studio Theater, including And L.A. is Burning, and many, many other roles across the country. Her next project is The Merry Wives of Windsor, coming up this season at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. Welcome, Celeste.
Thank you, and I've worked with you, Garrett.
We worked together at the Old Globe.
Coriolanus.
And Coriolanus.
Not many people can say that.
Speaking of Shakespeare's body.
Kick her right in the Coriolanus. Sorry.
Celeste was our very first guest, actually.
Yeah.
And it was in a time well before we had any sort of knowledge of equipment. And so the recording of her interview went the way of the world.
When the State of Shakespeare was just a twinkle in our eyes, Celeste came in and was our guinea pig.
Yeah.
So you're about to pull up your roots and go 1,000 miles from where you live to bring Shakespeare to another community. Why Shakespeare?
Well, I think it's important.
In what way?
I think there are very few things, and I'm speaking particularly about theater. I think there are very few things in this day of technology where we don't have to leave our homes to shop, to date. You know, you can have cyber sex. You can shop for anything online. You don't have to leave your home. You can live in absolute isolation. There are very few things these days that get us in a community of people to think things we might not have thought before or feel things that we wouldn't have felt. And I think that's invaluable. I think religious ceremonies do that for those people who partake in those. Sporting events do that. You know, when you're in an arena of people and there's excitement and disappointment and you're sharing that. And I think there is value. That's how we were made. We were made as a community. We've begun to isolate ourselves more and more. But I think it's deadening when we do that. And theater is the other one. You know, theater being live music, live plays, live, you know, poetry, whatever, where people come together in a room and are presented with a scenario where they laugh, they are moved to tears, they think, oh my God, I've never thought of that before. I think that's what keeps people alive. I don't know if I'm expressing myself well. So, no, Shakespeare's got it all. It's all relevant today. It's about mankind and humankind. And not, despite the fact, all the political references, it's fresh and alive and vibrant and funny.
Timeless,
and
timeless themes.
Yeah.
That's a nice segue into the piece that you've elected to share with us today, which is from...
Well, the last adjective I used was funny. I don't know if that's a good segue, but it's from Julius Caesar.
There is humor in the monologue. It's not like you said, it's not knee-slappingly funny, but Cassius uses humor.
Yeah, it's his weapon.
Let's introduce the monologue a little bit. We're talking about Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2, and the character is Cassius. Who is Cassius?
Cassius is a politician. And he is tired of seeing Caesar get all the credit and have all the power, where, you know, he feels like he's his equal in every single way, if not greater. And he just thinks he's tired of the injustice of being led by a feeble, in his mind, a feeble leader, and he's trying to get support from other men of power, like Brutus, to perhaps take Caesar down, to get him out of power.
Will you do the speech for us?
Sure.
This is Celeste Chula and Cassius from Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2.
I know that virtue to be in you, Brutus, as well as I do know your outward favor. Well, honor is the subject of my story. I cannot tell what you and other men think of this life, but for my single self, I had as lief not be, as live to be in awe of such a thing as I myself. I was born free as Caesar. So were you. We both have fed as well, and we can both endure a winter's cold as well as he, for once. Upon a raw and gusty day, the troubled Tiber chafing with her shores, Caesar said to me, "Darest thou, Cassius, now leap in with me into this angry flood and swim to yonder point?" Upon the word, accoutred as I was, I plunged in and bade him follow. So indeed he did. The torrent roared, and we did buffet it with lusty sinews, throwing it aside and stemming it with hearts of controversy. But ere we could arrive the point proposed, Caesar cried, "Help me, Cassius, or I sink!" As Aeneas, our great ancestor, did from the flames of Troy upon his shoulder the old Anchises bear, so from the waves of Tiber did I, the tired Caesar. And this man is now become a god, and Cassius is a wretched creature and must bend his body if Caesar carelessly but nod on him. He had a fever when he was in Spain, and when the fit was on him, I did mark how he did shake. 'Tis true, this god did shake. His coward lips did from their color fly, and that same eye whose bend doth all the world did lose his luster. I did hear him groan. Ay, and that tongue of his that bade the Romans mark him and write his speeches in their books. "Alas," it cried, "give me some drink, Titinius, as a sick girl. Ye gods, it doth amaze me, a man of such a feeble temper should so get the start of the majestic world and bear the palm alone."
Thank you. Thank you. That's lovely. What is it about this particular speech that attracts you?
I definitely understand his frustration of not being where he wants to be in his life, in his profession, in his, you know, in the world. And I understand, I mean, I think all of us understand these days being led by people that we don't necessarily respect.
I don't think it's actually far reach to say that if Caesar was the 1%, that Cassius is representing the 99%.
I think that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, Cassius is a moneyed person, right? But Caesar has accrued all of the power, and Cassius has a particular agenda. What is Cassius's agenda?
Well, another question before that's answered is, how has Caesar accrued the power?
Or arguably, has he?
Right.
Mark Antony would argue he has very different motives.
With very good arguments, Mark Antony would, yes.
Yeah.
So what was your question?
I don't remember. What is Cassius trying to accomplish?
He is trying to sabotage Caesar.
Would he be also trying to sway Brutus to his side to help him?
To help him, yeah. Alone, you know. Cassius is not powerful. He needs people to agree with him. It was just not one knife that stabbed Caesar.
There are several passages within this speech that you just read so beautifully, which really interest me. And one comes relatively early in the speech. Cassius presents this rhetorical riddle, which takes me a while to sort of figure out. It begins, I won't speak it for you. I'd love it if you'd share that little bit with us. But when you know you have to deliver a bit of text which is going to be difficult for the audience to follow, how do you approach it? What do you do?
Well, you have to make it clear in your own mind and speak it as clearly as possible. To me, the passage that is even more cloudy and harder to relate is the whole
I, as Aeneas our great ancestor, did from the flames of Troy upon his shoulder the old Anchises bear, so from the waves of Tiber did I the tired Caesar. That's a mouthful.
It's a long sentence.
But that's clearer to you than the other?
speaking for my own single self,
I'm not familiar with that tale of Anchises. It's not something that I was brought up with.
Right.
So when I hear a classical allusion like that, that escapes me, and hundreds of PhD students who are listening to this right now just shudder that I'm not well versed in the tale of Anchises, but I'm not.
Wow, you have hundreds of PhD students listening?
In the future, we may even have dozens. I have to admit that as an audience member, I do sort of tune out in that moment and then wait for the next bit to come along that I can relate to. What I get from the context of that is that there was a tired old man. I can picture this image. I don't know who Anchises was or what the circumstances were, but I can see it happening.
Great.
In my mind's eye.
Yeah.
So I get that. I get the idea of an old man being born from the waves. I get that. But our great ancestor, I don't get all of this stuff. So it takes me a while to put my attention on autopilot.
Well, I think you got the part of it that was most important. You know, yeah.
From the waves.
I carried Caesar from the waves like so-and-so carried this tired old man from the flames.
Right.
You know, who that old man is adds to it, but isn't necessary, you know, to get the image.
It's a different thing from when I'm presented with words that I do understand, but that are so complexly layered that I have to parse out the meaning of it.
So what's the line?
The line begins, and would you speak these words for us again? I cannot tell what you and other men think of this life, but for my single self, I had as lief not be as live to be in awe of such a thing as I myself.
I think what's confusing, most confusing in that line is the term as lief, because who knows what that means.
Right. Well, I'll chime in, because as an English major, I definitely knew the Anchises, or I call it Anchises, but pronunciation notwithstanding. I knew that legend, but I know leaf, but for
and
me,
leaf means?
I'd rather.
Right.
The tricky one for me was the first B, because that is the line that
I had
confused
as leaf
me.
Not be, or?
Yeah, I had as leaf not be as live to be. And when I just read it the first time, I was like, there's got to be a typo. It's got to be, I had leaf not be as alive, right? Because I didn't think about stressing the B.
Right.
As B.
As Barry Edelstein taught me, it's always about the verb.
Right. and of course, we all know that. We've been doing it. But
if I'm not mistaken, the line means is, look, I can't tell what you feel and other men feel, but I would rather not exist than spend my life being in awe of myself as he feels Caesar is.
So from a strictly textual standpoint, what we have is this verb, this little tiny two-letter verb, be, which carries a lot of meaning.
To be, or...
Right.
Right.
And it's used twice in that same line. I mean, you know, it's such a common word that you just sort of fly through it as a reader or on a first read. And so I actually asked Garrett, I wrote to him. I was like, what is that line six all about? And he explained it to me. Because leaf, I just couldn't... I knew leaf, and I was like... I don't get it. And you read it perfectly. I mean,
well,
you read it really well.
Thanks.
So as an actor, when you know that you're presenting the audience with a little thorny thought puzzle, but you have more words to speak afterwards, what do you do? Do you give them time to catch up? Do you push through? How do you handle it?
I think one of the frailties of being an actor in this situation is I might not know what is going to be most confusing for the audience, you know, like, okay, other lines were more confusing to me than that one. So had I known that that one was a stumper, I would have probably slowed it down and tried to make it more clear. That's what a director helps for, among many other things. So if I know that, I'm going to take extra care within reason. You don't want to stop a show to, you know, illustrate this means, you know, in context, often it, you know, like you figured it out in context.
Right. Eventually I figured it out, but it definitely stumped me for a little bit.
Yeah, and you don't want them to stop thinking to figure out one line, and meanwhile you've gone on with the rest and they've missed all that.
Yeah, I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And so you're presented with this dilemma as an actor. Do I give the audience time to catch up, Or do I press through because I, as a character living in the moment, have an urgency about what it is that I need to say?
Right. Well, you can only slow down or pause so much, because that will drop the energy and lose their attention even more than them missing a passage because they're still figuring something out. Most great directors that I know, when it comes to Shakespeare, allow us, and I as an actor tend to do this, start off more slowly in the first act, in the first scene, because their ears are adjusting to the language. And I think that's very important. And then as the plot picks up and as their ears have adjusted, you can pick up speed and momentum.
Well, in terms of your reading, I noticed that, you know, you gather, it was like a snowball. I mean, you gathered steam as you went along, and you got not just projection-wise and vocal energy, you got more, but in terms of the pace and the stridency of what you're doing, got stronger and stronger as the piece went on.
And that's certainly my interpretation. Like, you know, Cassius is a man, as so many in Julius Caesar, of intellectual prowess. So, you know, he's not so much a fighter as a thinker. And one might argue that he can't lose his temper or be overly emotional or he'll lose the argument. But in that particular speech, I think he does shoot himself in the foot just a little bit by, you know, and this is how I justify things, phrases like a sick girl. You know, I think he is losing it a little bit, but that's, again, my interpretation.
I'd really like to talk about one particular thing that fascinates me about this monologue, and that is the moment where, well, let me ask you, what is the point of no return for Cassius in this monologue?
I'm not sure of the point of no return. It is, to me, like a snowball, like you said, very accurately. There was a moment that Barry Edelstein pointed out that I still haven't figured out. There's a moment when he goes, and again, it's that line, I, as Aeneas, our great ancestor, did from the flames of Troy upon his shoulder. That I is not an I, letter I, it's an A-Y. Now, I've always looked at it as an I, but I remember Barry saying, complimenting saying, you know, despite the fact that he's a versist, saying, yes, there's a pause there.
So it's A-Y, yeah. And we're talking about line 23.
And so that's an important moment, and I haven't completely figured out all that's happening or what's happening, but I'd say that might be it, because it's different. It's an exception.
And it's always those little, like, O.
Right.
And I, yeah. A-Y. That a lot of inexperienced actors just overlook.
Yeah.
But they are so fundamental to the speeches.
Yeah.
And so scary for actors to do, you know, to open your mouth and go, oh, for a muse of fire. You
yeah.
know?
So but in that A-Y. Moment, he's saying, that's right. Like a hero from the Trojan War, I saved Caesar's ass, you know? And he compares himself to almost a demigod, Aeneas,
mm-hmm.
which could be argued as a mistake on his part, you know, as far as diplomacy goes.
How do you like to rehearse a piece when it's just you encountering a piece for the first time?
With a director in rehearsal, you mean, or on my own?
Well, the process typically, well, from my point of view, because I'm... Well, I could speak of atypical process. Atypical scenario would be that an actor would audition for a role, and in the preparation for the audition, there is no director.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's the actor
yeah.
encountering the words, perhaps for the first time.
Definitely.
What do you do?
First, read the play, and try not to focus on your character, though it's hard to do when you know you're going to be auditioning for a particular role. And then study the monologue. Try to make it as clear as possible. What is the story she's telling it to? Who is she telling it to? Why is she telling it? And then, you know, I often find that for an emotional arc for an audition, I have to go back to what just happened in the scene beforehand.
How much text work do you do? Like scansion and...
With Shakespeare, I absolutely go from the very da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, mostly looking for when it's not da-da-da-da-da-da, because that usually tells me there's an error in the edition, there's an emotional change, There's, you know, if there are more syllables packed in a line, it usually means either a lot of information is being imparted or emotionally something is happening.
Do you know where that happens in your speech?
Hmm?
Do you know where that happens in the Cassia speech, where there's more lines, more words?
I used to.
Well, it stands to reason that an actor will do this text work to become familiar with what the scene is about.
Yeah.
And glean clues from the structure, from the meter. And once those clues have informed a conception of the piece, it's no longer necessary for the actor to know, for example, that this might be an Alexandrian line or that there's a mid-stop here or there, because those things have become intrinsic to the actor's understanding and experience of the
right.
piece. So at very early on in the process, we may be hyper aware of where the irregular lines are. And after a while, we just know that something changes.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, I think, with any set of rules is that you get them so ingrained that when you actually go to perform, they're not in your mind at all. You know, whether it's football, you know where offsides is, but you're not going, oh, well, at the 10th, you know it. It's ingrained in your body and your mind, you know. Just as when we get up and actually perform in front of an audience, I'm not thinking, stress on that syllable. I'm actually speaking what I mean. All the homework has been done so thoroughly that it can be forgotten. You have to make Shakespeare, an Elizabethan language, clear to an audience to which it is not a first language. That's a job. You have to make the language clear. But after you make the language clear, I think you have to do very little else. You know, whereas in some material, you have to fabricate emotion. You have to, you know, generate excitement. If you speak Shakespeare clearly, it does it all for you.
Celeste Chula, thank you for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Celeste. Nice
thank
to meet you.
You.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for joining us on The State of Shakespeare. Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.